To be here as always. I'm going to talk about a project that's interesting to me, and well, whether it's interesting to you, we'll sort of find out as we go along. In the style of kind of American TV news, I'm going to do a sort of teaser, which says that I want their chairman to give me a big wave 5 minutes before the end, because the last 5 minutes I'm going to say something that's actually more likely to be of interest to those of you who care about giant components. So you sign me, and I'll tell you all to wake up. And so tune in. The news you need to know at 11:05. Okay, let's see how this works here. I like to start from real-world networks. A model starts as a graph. This is totally weird, bizarre, inexplicable, and crazy, because every interesting real-world network I can think of is much more informatively represented as an edge-rated graph. Unfortunately, Remco's examples show this. You know, you can look at the internet topology as, there's some link between here and here, but sort of why not sort of figure out how much traffic it takes and attach that as a number to it. Your sort of collaboration graph, somehow there's this idea that, let's see, I've got Erdős here, I've got Joel Spencer here, I want to, say how much interaction they've had. I'm going to write down either a 0 or a 1, depending on whether or not they've had an interaction. And why would anyone do that? I mean, it's such a crazy idea. Why not actually write down the number of papers they've had, or the lengths of these papers, or the number of citations they've had? These are much more informative ways of doing things.
How about the validity of the theorem?
Well, yeah. I'm looking at some things that are easily numerically measured, so I'm being lazy here. And, these sort of protein-protein interaction graphs, you have several thousand proteins. What you have to do is, for each pair you're measuring, you have to do some measurement. Where does this data come from? You have to do some measure. You have to get some numerical measurement of the interaction between them. Of course, mostly these are close to zero, but you have fuzziness here. So you actually have all these numbers. So you then simply threshold at some epsilon. And it gets crazy, because sort of some of the edges in the graph, you're sure are there, you already know this interaction, and some of them, wherever you bound the threshold, some by chance are going to be errors, and the graph doesn't tell you which is which. So you can go on forever here, but it's a rant. I have many rants, and I'll restrict them to only a few per lecture, but if you think about networks, you should just start as a default with edge-rated graphs, and someone should write a book which kind of starts there. Anyway, so why isn't this done? Okay, the answer is, of course, once you start thinking about it, it's hard to do, because, as I say on the slide, there are conceptually different interpretations. You have for any physical link, there's a notion of a capacity. Most familiar to us, perhaps, is in a traveling salesman problem. In that type of question, we think of the weight on an edge as representing a distance or a cost, something we're trying to minimize. The third one, which is what I'm focusing on, is where I think of the weight as a strength of interaction. So this is going back to, I want to measure the strength of association between Erdős and Joel here by some number. So somehow the bigger the number, the closer the relationship. And so our vague geometric picture here is that a high edge weight corresponds to being close. And of course, this is the opposite from what we're used to from TSPs. So there are a lot of opposites in this talk. A strong strength of association is being close in some abstract sense here. And again, lots of the social networks that people study are of this form, the kind of the distance between the weight on edge between two senators is just the sort of proportion of times they vote the same way, and so lots of things like that. Okay, so even there, so I'm now guessing wildly. I think if you took 100 interesting real-world networks, then maybe in 20 of them, natural interpretation, there's an edge weight, which is in some vague sense strength of association. But even then, at a more detailed level, you probably have 20 different meanings of what strength of association is. So in order to have a math version, I want to think that the strength of association number is measuring a frequency of interactions between them. So I'm going to work with interactions. And because I do probability and introduced randomness, I'm going to say the interactions happen at random times, completely random times, meaning the times of a Poisson process, and the meaning of the edge weight is, you know, the long run average number of interactions per unit time. Okay, it might be zero, but although bigger than zero. So this setting isn't at all new, and in particular it's a basic setting of a huge literature that probabilists call interacting particle systems that comes from statistical physics. And in this setting we have sort of another layer of structure. Individuals are in some states, and when they interact, their states update according to some rule. So there are literally thousands of papers in this world and dozens of models, so things like the voter model or basic epidemic models are in this particular line of work, and it's all ultimately going back to easing model type statistical physics. I'm doing something simpler, actually, so I'm just saying that as background, but we're going back to just looking at this level of sort of individuals interacting with each other. And what I'm going to call very vaguely the sort of imperfectly observed network problem is just to say that probably for many of these real-world networks, in particular the sort of biological ones, we actually have only a sort of imperfect knowledge of what the network actually is. So the issue is if we're interested in, you know, some feature of the network which we could work out if we knew exactly what the network is, then how well can we do it when we sort of don't know exactly what the network is? That's our question. And again, there are many ways you could sort of formalize this very vague question as a math question. I'm talking about the particular one suggested by what I said before. Again, I'm not actually claiming this is useful for real-world data, but I claim it's sort of interesting as a math theory. So I'm dealing with, you know, networks or graphs, but I mean sort of finite edge-weighted graphs. The statistic is just a number you can associate with any such graph, so it's a functional on graphs, and we'll assume that there's some real-world network out there which known vertices, but we don't know anything about the edges. But what we can observe is the interaction process described above. So at sort of time zero, we see no edges. As time goes on, but we start seeing these interactions, and the interaction across each edge is of time of a Poisson process, but with unknown, maybe zero weight. So basically, in time t, this is saying across each edge we've observed a Poisson number of interactions. And of course, the natural way, okay, I'm watching this, I see an interaction, well, I can just draw an interaction as an edge, and I shall see another interaction, etc. And of course, I see several interactions across different edges. So at time t, what I've observed, the data I've observed can be represented something like this. Those of you who remember the meaning of the word sufficient statistic will say that if we can sort of throw away the information about the exact time in the past when it happened, and that doesn't change anything. We haven't lost anything by throwing that away. So all the information is up to time t is conveyed by the numbers of interactions we've had. It's trivial, but kind of conceptually useful to say that there are two ways of representing this information as a multigraph here, the counting number of observed interactions, but also if you want to sort of represent this as a weighted graph that estimates the unknown true weighted graph, then we need to estimate what the weight on any particular edge is, and since the interpretation of the weight is the long run frequency of interactions per unit time, the natural estimate, of course, is the observed number divided by the observed time, so that to treat the observations as a weighted graph, I say I have a weighted edge of weight 1 over t here, and a weighted edge of rate 3 over t here, because at time t, if that's my data, this is my estimate of what the unknown rate actually is. According to your philosophical leanings, you can call that the natural estimate or the naive frequentist estimate, and I'm going to call it the... totally clumsy with physical objects, I'm sorry, here. So we can represent the observations in two equivalent ways, as a random multigraph with the observed number of copies of each edge. or I can just divide those number of copies by T, and that's a sort of observed random weighted graph where we're sort of trying to do a crude estimate of what the weights are. So this is our setting, and now for a given statistic of networks, I want to estimate the statistic of the true network, I see this observed network, how do I proceed? That's just a version of my picture here. So, giving a sort of long introduction talking round here. So this is a framework because, of course, there are lots of different questions you can ask about networks, and your sort of favorite question, you can sort of, whatever you know in this, whatever you've sort of done about it, sort of assuming a network is known, you can sort of lift up and say, well, what if we don't actually know what the network is? There are many other ways one can sort of formalize the concept of imperfectly observed networks, and if I have time, I'll show a completely different one. Why is this frequentist estimator naive? Well, you have to imagine a person who actually adopts this in real life. That means you go through life saying that if something has never happened in the past, it has zero chance of happening in the future. And that's just a very naive attitude to reality. So that's why it's a frequentist estimator, but you have to remember it's a bit naive. Also, technically, we're interested in doing some complicated nonlinear function of parameters, the edge weights, and one way you can do that is estimate the parameters and then sort of apply the functional to the estimate, but there's no reason to think that's optimal in any sense. I mean, it's just sort of, you have non-linearity. If you want to estimate the square of an expectation, you can do it by estimating an expectation and squaring it, but nothing in the world suggests that's the optimal way of doing it. But it's got a convenient way of doing it. Just to be equally critical of all statistical philosophies, there's a sort of naive Bayes estimate, which in interesting ways is sort of kind of opposite to the naive frequentist estimator, and that's another talk, and I won't dwell on it, except maybe at the end. Another conceptual point is that I'm thinking of computation as free here, so I'm not concerned with time in the computational complexity sense of time for computation. Our cost here is the observation time here. So it's like, you can analyze census data, but the effort in analyzing census data is infinitely less than the effort in actually collecting the census data in the first place. So we're kind of in that type of world here. So as I said, the simplest estimator to talk about is this sort of, you just take our observation, take our observed or estimated random weighted graph and just apply our statistic to that. Whether you do that, I'm writing that down on the slides just to avoid notation for other things. The point is that sort of the error of your estimate is going to depend on the unknown true graph. So, how do you make a theorem like that are useful? And the answer is we can't. But the more useful or elegant way of thinking about it is that we want to define a stopping rule. So we just say, well, I'm going to start observing this network, and instead of deciding in advance how long we're going to observe it, we sort of do it on the fly. We have some online algorithm, and after some time, of course, implicitly will depend on what the true graph is, but sort of the time after some time determined by a specified rule, we stop observing it, and then we do make some estimate of our statistic. And we want this to be sort of uniformly accurate in a relative sense. So I'm thinking of ratios of estimated values to true value are close to one, with sort of error plus or minus epsilon, and the probability of errors sort of more than one plus or minus epsilon is smaller than epsilon. But, and the hard part, I want this to be uniform over all possible true networks. So the uniformity is what we are interested in. So this is a tough challenge. We're trying to do something rather hard here, and how often can we do this? So, and of course, implicitly, we want to, you can do anything if you run forever. But implicitly, we want the stopping time to be small in some sense we'll talk about later. So that's the project I'm talking about. Bottom line is, we actually have no idea how to do this in most interesting cases. That's why it's interesting project. We can do it for a few statistics that are less interesting and less natural. Ongoing joint work with a grad student. Anyone who wants to pursue these ideas in different directions is welcome to do so, but don't write a paper for another year till I get my student out. So let's see, still doing a bit more discussion here. Again, there's each vertex, we think of as a person, each vertex has a total interaction rate with other people. So people used to thinking of discrete time, here we can scale the weights arbitrarily. They're real numbers, we can multiply by a million, we can divide by a million, that just scales time. So scale time doesn't mean anything without any sort of reference or standardization. And just to think about it, it's easier to... We want, in general, to think of all these interaction rates as being order one, and just to be more concrete, let's just sort of think of the total interaction rates for each individual being one. So that just means that in time t, we've sort of observed, on average, t interactions per vertex. So our multigraph has, on average, t edges per vertex. Let's just make sense of what t means. A little thought says there are three time regimes. If t is little o of 1 as n goes to infinity, then, well, most vertices, you don't see any edges. You can't see much about the graph. If you think about birthday-type problems, if t is sort of just little o of 1, you can estimate the degree distribution, by which I mean sort of the analog of degree distribution for weighted graphs, just by statistical sampling. So you have to think about that, it's true. But somehow, to t is little o of 1 isn't so interesting, except for the very local thing. So the other extreme, if you're interested in connectivity, the coupon collector's problem tells you, again, sort of generically, not all the time, that it's going to take you time log n. And so at time log n, especially in the case where, of what I'm going to call sparse graphs, if you've seen log n edges at each vertex, and if you have sort of only a few close friends, then you're going to see log n interactions with your close friends, so you know the weights extremely accurately. So again, at the time it's the observed graph is connected, you have very good estimates of what's going on, at least for certain things. So again, you can estimate anything well, and so there are lots of problems in formalizing that, but sort of conceptually. So the conceptually interesting regime to me is where t is a largish constant. You've seen 13 or 33 interactions per person on a very large graph, and what can you then say about the unknown true graph here?
Just go back. So for discussion purposes, you're assuming W sub V is 1, but when you're making the inference,
No. So I'm trying to avoid this. This is just to make sense of the times. So yes. No. The actual theorems, I'm giving a very high-level talk without any details. But I just want to say that in theorems, we want to assume nothing if we can. But generally, if these weights vary a lot, then that somehow messes things up and it just has to go in any bounds. Yeah. I'm kind of going to insult my audience by asserting that you've never actually appreciated the logic of freshman statistics, and because it's tricky. And in fact, I gave this talk last week at Berkeley and inadvertently demonstrated my own thesis, so proof by accident. So I demonstrated my thesis that this is unintuitive by sort of doing it on the board and getting it wrong. So this is my, so however, this old dog can be taught new tricks, so I've written it out here. So again, I'm just going to say here. So, again, it's weird. I mean, suppose we start off with the theorem of this format. So if our true graph has some property, then, with 95% probability, our sort of observed graph, which is random, has a related property Q. So now, what's the inference? What does this tell us sort of in the real world if we observe this? So the inference is the counterfactual direction. The inference is that we can make from this is that if G obs doesn't have property Q, then we're at least 95% confident that G2 does not have property Q star. And this is what we explain to freshman statistics students, and they don't understand it very well, but that's what a confidence interval is, literally. So this is all we're going to do here, but of course we want to make our inference in positive terms, so I negate everything. Now, so exactly the same assertion, sort of backwards, is I want to end up with. So I'm interested in inference from observation to truth. So the format I want to end up with is this inference. If I observe a certain property, then I want to be confident that the true graph has some related property. So now the issue is, what is the actual theorem that I need to justify this inference? As before, it's in the counterfactual form. The theorem is of the format, if the true graph does not have property P star, then with 95% probability, the observed graph does not have property P. And, this is weird. So my basic comment is, you know, this is why people become Bayesians, because this logic is so kind of counterintuitive that it's hard to deal with, and that nobody really understands that. But it sort of messes up our intuition for what we're doing. Because if you're used to sort of random graph models, you have a notion of desirability, desirable properties, and you think that our job is to prove that our random graphs have some desirable property. But here, if you want to make inferences about a desirable property, so if the inference at the top is some sort of good property, then you think, if you're not paying attention, you think that the theorem you have to prove is that if the true graph does have this good property, then your observed graph will likely have the good property. But that's exactly the wrong theorem. You're now confused. You actually have to prove the theorem the other way. You have to prove that if your true graph doesn't have the good property, then your observed graph also doesn't have a property. And this is incredibly bizarre to keep in mind. So if I think of sort of connectedness as a good property, so instead of saying that if G2 is connected, we want to prove that G, the observed graph, is well connected, we sort of have to prove the opposite. But of course the good news is that our intuition says that, you know, adding randomness, so we think of the observed thing as sort of fuzzy, a randomized version of the true thing, and well, this generally makes nice properties worse, so which is the direction we want. So, okay, so let me give a little example of this. If we want to measure connectedness, the connectedness of a weighted graph, I'm being a little inconsistent about notation, my weighted graph G or by the weights W, a basic, you know, mathematically nice quantification is the spectral gap of the graph Laplacian, that is our set of edge weights is naturally considered as the off-diagonal elements of a symmetric matrix, and we complete the matrix by making the diagonals be sort of minus the total interaction rate. Of course, in probabilistic terms, this is just the generator of an actual continuous time random walk on the graph, so it has a probabilistic meaning sort of separate from the math. And again, just to remind you of which way this goes, so saying that the gap is zero. Gap is zero is saying that the graph is not connected. So now the size of the gap is the sort of quantifying of as quantification of how well connected it actually is. That's the direction it goes here. So one line proof based on the sort of extremal characterization of eigenvalues here tells us immediately that the expectation of the gap for our observed or estimated graph is always less than or equal to the true gap. Normally, again, if you're interested in spectral gaps, there's always a cheap inequality, and always Murphy's law tells us the cheap inequality goes in the wrong direction. But here, Murphy rules, the cheap inequality goes in the right direction, because if we think of being connected as good, so we want to sort of get a lower bound on the true measure of connectivity, and this gives us a magically the estimates in the direction we want. That's good. However, Murphy has a trick up his sleeve. Murphy is pretty slippery here, that the bound is true but trivial, because generally, for T is order 1, our observed graph isn't connected by the coupon collector's rule, so we're getting true but non-informative lower bound of zero here. So we have to go. So if we wanted to pursue this idea to estimate the spectral gap, well, we'd have to sort of continue until the stopping time at which our observed graph is connected. Of course, here I'm implicitly assuming it's only going to work if the true graph is connected. Unfortunately, if we're careful, if we avoid another trap that Murphy has provided for us, just plugging a random time t into the first equation doesn't work. You have to be slightly more subtle and appeal to Wald's identities. You have to work with sort of unnormalized edge counts. But if you do it the right way, again, we get the similar lower bound for the gap by sort of running up to any stopping time, any stopping rule we choose where it's connected. And in theory, we get this bound in terms of the expectation of the stopping time and the expectation of the gap at that time. Of course, are we done? Well, this is, we're getting somewhere, but we're a long way from anything useful because sort of we got one realization of a pair of random variables, so you got the expectations, and one realization doesn't tell us much. So we either have to sort of repeat this a bunch of times so we can estimate the expectation from the average, or if we're magical, we might have some theoretical knowledge that these random variables are actually concentrated around their means, in which case one observation would get us somewhere. So we'll come back to that in a minute. However, as I said, you know, these are interesting as math questions, but conceptually it's the wrong time regime. So here's my holy grail. This is the holy grail that I'd like to do. So I'm looking at, time 33. So everyone has 33 edges. Our intuition from Erich Renyi and everything else is that, we're n's large. We probably have a very large giant component, probably maybe 99% of the vertices are in a connected component. And moreover, by sort of pruning off some sort of fringe elements of that, we can go down to a slightly smaller but still large, and we're going to get 97% of the vertices are in a subset such that the induced graph on that subset is now sort of well connected in some way you can do by spectral gap or however you like to measure that. So the theorem we'd like to prove, or the inference we'd like to make, is that sort of if we observe this expected type of high connectivity in our observed graph, then we can infer that the true graph has something similar. At the intuitive level, this is somehow completely obvious just from our mantra that your randomization makes connectivity worse. This just has to be true, but I have no idea how to sort of make a nice formalization of this by a number and actually do an estimate. So again, this is my holy grail. I'm just reminding you of the program again. However, we can approach this in a sideways way. This is the old joke about looking for your dropped car keys under the lamppost. What can we do? Take your favorite object. The objects here are sort of triangles or spanning trees. Some k. And I say I want to consider the stopping time for my observation process. So the first time that our observed multigraph contains k edge disjoint copies of this type of object. Of course, we can use different edges between the same vertices here. Here's a proposition. So we're measuring concentration because everything can be scaled in time. It has to be of the form sort of standard deviation over expectation. But that's saying this is small is what we mean by sort of being weakly concentrated here. And we have these inequalities that are sort of completely independent of the underlying graph, and of course get small as k goes up. So these are kind of weird. I'm not sure. You can see, the reality is that sort of by cheap multiplicative sub-multiplicative arguments, they're actually for each k they're bounded by rather cheap arguments. But somehow the fact that you can get good estimates, explicit estimates on the k's going down is the slightly more amazing thing. So now we've sort of done some version of our program completely by accident, because I remember our program was sort of what statistics of a graph can we estimate from our observed process. So I can sort of, the expectation of one of these stopping times TK is a number associated with the weighted graph, so that's a statistic of the weighted graph, and our program is to show that we can estimate that statistic accurately, and that's what these theorems say. We can sort of, if K is large and the bound is small, then we can sort of estimate this with the prescribed error by just sort of running up to time TK, so we can estimate the expectation of TK in time TK. If I was doing this for K equals 1, it wouldn't be small. I could have to repeat the process several times to get independent samples. But it is. So of course, these are sort of bizarre and unnatural statistics, and that there's no particular reason you'd consider these, other than the spanning tree one being some measure of connectivity. But of course, it's related to what I was saying at the bottom there, that actually knowing that random variables are concentrated around their means sort of helps us with sampling. We only have to sample them once to estimate their expectation here. Okay, so this comes from, I'm going to outline very briefly in words where this comes from, because there's an open problem I want to ask the graph theorists about. So there's some abstract structure, which is our process. It's a Markov process, which is a sort of increasing set-valued process. We have a set of edges, so we just add one new edge at a time. Very generally, for such processes, we can bound this variability of stopping times, which some increasing property holds. So the property we're looking for here is increasing in the sense that if you add an edge to a graph, the property still holds. So there's some general arguments that have nothing to do with the particular structure here. And of course, at some point, we have to do a calculation involving the particular objects we're looking at, triangles and spanning trees, and can say in words what this is. And it's sort of trivial in these two cases, but not in another. So I'm going to treat this as a game. I'm going to choose a multigraph with the given contains k edge disjoint objects property. I'm then going to delete an edge, and then I'm going to show you that graph. Now the issue is, I want you to show that there are many different ways that by creating a few new edges, you could restore that property. So of course you can do it by replacing the one edge that I deleted, but I want a structure theory that tells me there are many ways of doing it. So why does this work in my examples? So what happens if I have a graph that contains k-spanning trees, and without loss of generality, nothing else, delete one? Well, I've sort of deleted... deleting one edge of a spanning tree sort of cuts the vertices into two sets. What do you have to do to get back a spanning tree? Well, you just have to put back any edge between that component and that component, and of course there are at least n of those edges, so you can do that. That's easy to do. Triangles, I've got k triangles somewhere in a graph. I've cut one of them. What do I have to do to get back to k triangles? Well, kind of have to think simple. I just sort of create a triangle somewhere else, three edges. So in these two cases, it's easy to do. This is the central point of a proof here. And the actual bound, I haven't said that the bound is a little hard to understand. The bound is basically involves the mean time that it takes the observation process to do this restoration. And you have to relate that to the thing we're interested in, and so magically it works in this case. However, the next thing I'd like to do and can't is where the property is that our observed graph is k-edge connected. So this open problem, very vague, is say if I do this game, I think of a I start with a k-edge connected graph, I delete an edge, I show it to you. The question is, can you show that there are always many different ways of getting back to the k-edge connected property by sort of adding a few edges? So there you are. I don't know. Menger theorem doesn't help. Who knows? So I'd be very interested if there's any theorem there that graph theorists know. And of course, this doesn't involve probability. It's pure graph theory question. And of course, if you can think of any other interesting objects where you can play this game, I'd like to know too. Okay, so those are unnatural ones. I'm going to do... I'll talk about more natural ones briefly. Maximum matching. So you all know what a matching is. You're probably, if you're in the TSP world, you're used to minimum matchings because they're costs, but here I'm trying to match you with your friends, and your friends have a high weight on it, so we want maximum matchings here. So there's every possible matching has a weight, so there's a maximum weight matching. I'm not interested in matching itself, I'm just interested in the weight of the maximum weight estimate. Can we estimate this from our observations? So I'd say this is a basic example where the naive estimate is completely stupid, because if I do this on the complete graph with constant edge weights, which will have to be sort of 1 over n minus 1, then what I see at time t is our old friend Erdős Rényi. So I see Erdős Rényi with a sort of Poisson t number of edges, and my observed weight, my estimated weight, is 1 over t. So now, what's the, in order of magnitude, what's the weight of the maximum matching? Well, basically everyone, or at least half the vertices, I can match up with somebody by the greedy algorithm. So my the weight I get is order n over t. So my for the observed weight, I get n over t. On the other hand, the true graph, the complete graph, every edge has weight 1 over n, so the true answer is a half, and now in order for this to get close to that, t has to be order n, and we want t to be order 1. So again, for stupid reasons, the naive frequentist estimator doesn't work. So we are going to, anytime you say a word that sounds bad in English, it's better in French. So in English we're going to cheat. French, we're going to finesse the problem here. It just sounds a lot better. We finesse the problem here as follows. So the idea is that sort of we want our estimates to be valid. We want what we say to be true in the sense that the error bounds are guaranteed. There's a difference between being true and informative. So we take the view that sort of real world graphs are sparse, so we only care about results that are informative for sparse case. And of course in sparse case where you have sort of weights a half or a third for close friends, again the greedy algorithm shows you that in fact the maximum weight is going to be order n. So if we think the maximum weight is going to be order n, then of course we divide by n as the thing we're going to estimate. So we think of the problem as estimating this sort of maximum weight per vertex, and now we think of saying we want to estimate this up to smaller additive error. So in the bad cases, this is going to zero, and we're estimating it by things going to zero, and additively, we're right. So again, this is sort of cheating slightly, but in the spirit of the game. A moment's thought. This topic interacts with 25 interesting areas of different theory. A classic statistic thing has the unseen species problem, which more poetically, how many words did Shakespeare know? I mean, we know how many he wrote down, but presumably he knew a lot of words he never had occasion to write down. So how do you estimate that? A large literature on that, and we basically have this issue in terms of what do we say about the edges we haven't seen if we're not a naive frequent and assume they're not there. But the idea that intuition says that your first attempt as an estimator is to say, well, we'll take this naive estimator, but we'll only kind of count edges where we've seen at least two interactions, and that sort of gets rid of the problem, and basically that then works. So I'm just sort of I won't go through this, but we can estimate our original max weight problem by an estimator based on doing the natural thing, except we only count edges we've had two observations of. And again, so we want to say that our additive error here is bounded by something that depends on t uniformly of all finite edge-rated graphs, and the best you can hope for by just considering the trivial case of one edge is order t to the minus a half, and kind of the obvious but tedious arguments can get you close to that here, the little footnotes. Another attitude, so I have sort of three what I call natural examples. So my first were a little artificial. So there are sort of three possibilities, which is either the sort of naive estimator works, or some other estimator works, or it doesn't work at all, or no estimator works. So I kind of have examples of all three. So that's an example where the naive estimator doesn't work, but you can fudge. For my version of community structure, I'm ignoring computational complexity. So I basically say that for every size m, I just look at the maximum over size m vertex sets of the density of edges within that set. So that's just a number depending on m. Again, there's a number for the true graph. I can just plug in the same number for my observed graph. Here the randomness, if we're trying to make this big, here the randomness makes things better because we can sort of randomly choose the set of vertices rather than it being fixed. So we expect this observed quantity to be bigger than the true quantity, and then so the inference we want is that we can infer that the true quantity is in an interval a little to the left of the observed quantity. And to make sense, you need the set of vertices to go up as order log, just because bounded size sets n goes to infinity, everything can happen. But again, the even easier results, just plugging into large deviations and counting, give you an estimate which is somehow of the right form here. And you can sharpen this up. This is just the most sort of naive way of doing things imaginable. Gets you something here. Do I have my 5-minute signal yet? Not yet. Okay, that's good. Okay. So here's an example where it's impossible to do it. So even a very weak thing is impossible. This is first passage percolation. Remco is going to talk about this on Thursday, and my psychic ability is to tell me he's going to do a sort of slightly different version of the same idea formally here. You're not, okay. You're not. Yeah, okay, that's fine. Remco is not going to talk about this. This is different from what Remco would have talked about if he was going to talk about it. Okay, so I'm in the... So my same setting, the edge-weighted graph. I'm going to kind of distinguish two vertices too, and I use the edge weights to parameterize independent random variables with exponential distributions, but where the weights are the edge weights again. So an edge weight is large, means you're a close friend, you communicate often. These random variables are small, so these are sort of times between the times between meeting times here, the traversal time of an edge. And so the first passage percolation time is just the sort of minimum of the sum of these edge traversal times over all paths here. That's a random quantity, but we take the expectation and that's our statistic. So again, we think of the vertices as fixed, but the edge weights as variable, so we just have this expectation as a function of the unknown edge weights. And now we play our game. How can we estimate this if we don't know the edge weights? The first observation is that we can do this in a rather trivial way by using our observational process, which is based on exponential random variables, to just directly simulate the first passage process itself. So we can estimate this by sort of simulating the random variable XW, and doing that once gives you order of magnitude, and doing it a bunch of times gives you a more accurate estimate. So again, it's complicated because we have two notions of time. Sort of time in our world is observation time of watching the whole process. And that's sort of different from watching the process of this sort of percolation thought of as water spreading out. Okay, but on the other hand, if you have a linear graph, if I tell you my graph is just linear edges and the weights are unknown in detail but order one, then of course our first passage time from there is order n. It takes the time for the percolation takes time order one every time. On the other hand, to calculate the expectation, we just have a formula for the expectation, which is just sum one over the edge weights. So I can estimate that by summing the edge weights. You just need a sort of constant number of observations from the edge weights to know its edge weight. And so again, my Groupon collector's problem, I just need time observation time log n for me to be able to estimate the individual edge weights and then calculate the expectation. So in this example, in this restricted class, we can estimate the value of the first passage percolation mean much quicker than actually simulating the random variable that this is the mean of. Okay, so based on these two things, the weakest possible thing you might say is that let's just try and improve this sort of simulation idea. Is a way of estimating this time such that the time is always of the same order, or it's never larger than actually simulating the random variable itself, but for nice graphs is smaller. The answer is you can never do it. There's no universal algorithm that can do this on any nice graph. And the answer, I won't try and go so through this in detail, but the answer is somehow if there was a gap between these two times, you could kind of sneak in another graph which your algorithm wouldn't see, but which sort of gave you if your algorithm doesn't see the presence of another graph, then whether or not that other graph is present sort of isn't going to affect your algorithm's estimate, but you can have the sort of invisible graph that there be creating an actual shorter percolation time. So it's not quite a proof for computational complexity, but it's an argument that convincing that we can't actually do it. Okay, I'm at my 5 minutes yet. Yes, okay, 5 minutes. There you are. There are three ways I can go, and I'm going to go to wake up everyone. Let me go to the Bond percolation on general weighted graphs thing. This is the same math setting, but conceptually different, because I'm not doing inference anymore. So we're going to have this arbitrary edge-weighted graph. Again, as before, to each edge I'm creating exponential random variables, again with these arbitrary weights. I want to do bond percolation, which just means that at time zero none of these edges are there, but each edge opens at this random time. So at any time we have a set of open edges, and that, you know, gives us a typically disconnected graph, but we can look at the size of the connected components, and we can look at the size of the largest number of connected components. So if I take the complete graph with constant edge rates, this is, of course, Erdős-Renyi, and if you sort of take your d-dimensional lattice with constant edge rates, it's sort of classical percolation theory, but I want completely general, completely general. Can you prove anything completely generally? So here's the preprint. So I can, again, I'm letting n go to infinity, so I have a sequence of such graphs as n goes to infinity, entirely arbitrary up to our time standardization. So you remember in Erdős-Renyi, sort of p is t over n, and we sort of, the natural time parameterization is the t, and t equals 1 is the critical value. So again, we can sort of time scale arbitrarily. So the assumptions are that there's some small t1, such that the mean size of the largest component at time t1 is little o of n, and then there's some big t2 such that the mean size at time t2 is not little o of n. That's it. So that this says that a giant component emerges with non-vanishing probability sometime in this interval. So here's the theorem. It's a bit hard to do the quantifiers. Given any such sequence of graphs, there's a deterministic sequence such that if I look at the times tn, the largest component is bigger than, you know, some small number times n, then, because these random variables depend on the epsilon n, but for every choice of epsilon n going slowly, these random times are deterministic to first order. So that's the theorem. And in jargon, there's this notion of incipient time in the infinite world. So this is the analog of what people in the infinite world call the incipient giant component time here. And of course, it's not surprising that this holds for every natural graph, but it's kind of slightly remarkable to me that basically, you know, it holds, you know, universally. You know, it has nothing to do with lattices or Erdős-Renyi. It's just an entirely universal property. And again, as far as I know, no one's really, you know, thought about this. People have thought about, you know, these percolation-type problems on lots of specific graphs, but the idea that there's some completely general result like this. So that, you know, the second order properties, you know, people think a lot about, you know, the scaling window and the, you know, the second order analog of this first order result, which of course is very model dependent, but the idea that it's kind of like the law of large numbers. Once upon a time, people thought the law of large numbers had something to do with independence. And Birkhoff said, no, it's the ergodic theorem. No, nothing to do with independence whatsoever. So somehow, these giant components, the things, in some sense, at the first order, actually have nothing to do with all the structure people use here. But so this relies on the same concentration trick that we talked about earlier, and it's ultimately something which has a sort of a two-line proof if you look at it the right way. So this is why we have the archive, so you can look at these things. Okay, I'm done. Thank you.
I'm confused about something.
Okay.
You know, you're dealing with these edge-weighted random graphs, which you might as well all consider to be the complete graph where some of the weights happen to be zero.
Sure, yeah, good. Yeah.
In which case, it seems the problem is that you've got these n choose 2 independent Poisson random variables,
yeah,
and you're trying to estimate these n choose 2 parameters.
Yeah.
And that this whole thing is like invariant under permutations of the n choose 2 parameters, and that there isn't actually any graph theory in there, that you could have stated it as, here's a measurement of a bunch of Poisson random variables, determine the parameters.
Well, sure. I mean, sure, but I mean, at a completely abstract level, that's true. But the questions I'm asking about connectivity or containing triangles or containing spanning trees, and those are graph theory questions. I mean, one could state all those without using graph theory, but it would be perverse to do so. I mean, yeah. No, you're right. I mean, abstract, but I mean, somehow, you know, sure. I'm not intending to do this for a completely arbitrary functional. I mean, I'm only, you know, that's like saying, what can I say about an arbitrary continuous function? I mean, you know, I'm trying to sort of, the project is to sort of do it for sort of specific, interesting functionals. Yeah.
So let me just cut this down to a specific case. Suppose you have basically a random subgraph of H, where H is some, is not all of Kn. So it seems okay. Like you could do this by just having the weights be zero outside of H, and having all the weights be one, if I got your
okay.
On H. And then would this be, would this special case be of interest, or would it already be known? I'm not sure.
I honestly don't know what, you know, right, I know some of the literature that people have done. I mean, I guess Fan Cheng and someone have cases under, but they're under odd hypotheses which make the kind of components look locally tree-like. So as in Erdős Rényi. So under some, I mean, she never says this, but you right. So I mean, again, this has nothing to do with, you know, assuming that sort of components are locally tree-like. That this is sort of magic, somewhat magic abstract stuff here. Yeah. Okay, Remco.
You would believe that also the time at which this occurs, not only the difference between the two stopping times converges in Kolmogorov to zero, but maybe also themselves.
Well, sure, in any natural family, but remember, everything's arbitrary, so it's not like I'm sort of having, you know, right, but obviously, conceptually we have models where sort of we have the same rule for different n, but, you know, I'm just, yeah, I mean, obviously you could take some sequences and they do, but by compactness, but somehow there's no connection between the nth and the n plus first one here.
And do you get any bound?
Well, you know, intuitively, a bound would have to depend on some structure. So, I mean, I can't believe there's a bound that just depends on n. You're right. I mean, so it's an open problem to show that. I rather suspect you could find examples that went arbitrarily slowly in n. I'm just guessing. You know, it's possible that there might be some bound that just depends on n, but I kind of doubt it. It's partly because you're making the total weights vary widely. Somehow weird things tend to happen, so you might have to have some bound on. Right, so maybe if the weights didn't vary widely, it would be true. I mean, the non-zero weights not varying widely, it might be true. That's just the intuition.
Somehow
there.
Your assumption in three, they basically rule out two wild behavior.
Right, exactly. So the behavior where this doesn't work, and again, it works for anything you consider natural, but if I kind of consider a large linear graph where the weights sort of go down geometrically to the minus I, then somehow obviously you percolate, you know, very, very slowly. So there's some big N here, but sort of it doubles the time to get to here, sort of it's the same as the time to get there, so things are just spreading out incredibly slowly here. But basically it's sort of wild examples like that where it doesn't work for kind of trivial reasons. But somehow the issue is that somehow the actual sort of shape of the graph or the exact weights don't matter at all. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Thank the speaker again.